At Her Spirit, we're here for you. We want to help you discover your potential, achieve your goals, ignite your fitness, find your community. Head to herspirit.co.uk and sign up for our core membership. Get access to our virtual classes, monthly challenges, expert advice, and track your progress in our health hub. You'll also find your very own cheerleading squad who will support you every step of the way. Use the code HERSPIRITPOD3 and get 3 months completely free. It's time for you.
Hello, welcome everybody to 2021 and the first Her Spirit podcast of 2021. Me, Louise Minchin, and my lovely friend and co-presenter, Annie Emerson. It's lovely to see you. How are you?
It's lovely to see you, Lou. And I'm sort of really positive and looking forward to 2021. Not been an easy 2020, so let's hope lots of positive things to look forward to. How are you? How are you?
I'm good. I'm mending, you know, and 2021, I've got plans, obviously, for after my foot operation. But, you know, who knows, Annie? Who knows? But we get better at who knows. One thing I do know, we have got an absolutely fantastic, a gold star guest for our first guest of 2021. I don't think I've ever actually been allowed to interview her on BBC Breakfast myself, but she's just fantastic. She is. Lots of people describe her as the mother of tennis. That's for lots of different reasons. She's a fantastic tennis player herself. She's a brilliant coach. She also happens to have a couple of children who are quite good at tennis. That is, of course, a massive underestimation. She is the one and only Judy Murray. How lovely to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I feel very honoured to be in your company on a podcast.
And I'm really excited. I'm really excited to talk to you anyway, but also because I realised today that you are, in fact, I've always loved you. And I realised one of the reasons why is because you and I share the same birthday. And we confirmed that by both turning up the same jumper today.
Yeah, we did. Twins. It was meant to be.
Oh, it's wonderful to see you. Should we just first question, I suppose, 2021, gosh, I mean, last year was something else, wasn't it? What are your kind of thoughts going at the start of a brand new year?
Well, we've got to be hoping for a happier, healthier, safer, sportier for me anyway, 2021. But yeah, I mean, who could ever have imagined that that was what 2020 was going to throw at us, or that it was going to last so long? But, you know, I feel like there's light at the end of the tunnel somewhere now because of the vaccine. I think that might help us all to be a bit more patient for a bit longer. So, yeah, I think, you know, by summer, I'm hoping that we will have a more back to normal existence. And until then, yeah, do what we're told, keep our fingers crossed, and keep looking forward and stay upbeat. We've got to stay upbeat, haven't we? It's not so easy.
It's definitely not easy, is it, Judy? And I think there are people that will find it a lot more easy to stay positive because it's part of your kind of psyche, isn't it? You either are one of those people with a glass half full or you are one of those people with a glass half empty. And it has been an incredibly tough year for everyone. I don't think anyone has escaped this without being affected by it. And it's been a very tough year for sports people, hasn't it? You know, and I just wonder what your thoughts are on how do you keep going as a sports person if there is no competition and you don't know when the next one's coming?
Yeah, I think every sport has its own individual challenges. And I think in my sport, which of course is tennis, they've done an incredible job, the women's tour and the men's tour and some of the Grand Slams, to be able to put events on, you know, to create bubbles, to create safe environments, to put the thing on with no crowds, very limited opportunity to service your sponsors, which of course has a massive financial implication on the business. And many of the tournaments, especially the Grand Slams, the profits that they make are generated back into the host country's coffers to develop the game for the rest of the year. So everything has a massive knock-on effect. And I know from Jamie and Andy's point of view, being able to compete, they absolutely are so appreciative of the efforts that have gone on to make some of the events happen. But, you know, once they're there, it's a strange environment for them as well, because you're bubbled in the hotel, you're limited who you can practice with, you know, once you you can go out and play your match and go to, or do your practice and go to the gym. But once you're back in the hotel, you're pretty much stuck in the hotel. You know, obviously you can't go out. So I think it's been very challenging. I think the no crowds is a huge thing. I mean, for all of us who are sports fans, it's tough enough not having as much live sport to watch. But I think for competitors playing in empty stadiums without fans, you know, you feed off the crowd, don't you? You feed off the noise, whether that's positive noise for you or negative noise against you, it's always there. And you're actually out there having to bring the intensity and the concentration and the attitude and the motivation all through yourself, especially in an individual sport like tennis. Maybe in a team sport, you've got your teammates around you. But, you know, it's like everything. It doesn't matter what you do, you know, sport or any other walk of life, we're all having to adapt.
You've just taken me right back to one of my favourite moments. And I've only been able to watch go to Wimbledon like a couple of times in my life to watch it. But I did watch Andy on his way, one of the matches on his way when he won the first time he won the final. And it was just so intense, isn't it? It's and literally you talking about it has just taken me right back into that kind of theatre that it is like. And gosh, it's been, you know, as you say, bad for us, bad for people who play tennis.
Yeah, I think it's really hard. I mean, where the players at the top end of the game have been able to play to a certain extent because there have been a limited number of events, the players further down the ranking chain, they haven't had that luxury because the smaller tournaments are not able to put the safety mechanisms in place. There's very little prize money in the lower events. So are you going to get on a flight and cross borders or cross continents to try to find competition? The countries that have been able to put things on in their own backyards, it's been an opportunity to really showcase what you can do yourself in your country so that people have not had to travel. And Jamie has put on a number of events through the summer that have been called Battle of the Brits. And he's done a remarkable job to create competition in their backyard for the British players.
Now, talk about remarkable job. We're going to talk about you a lot, obviously. We both last night watched Driving Force, a documentary which you star in, which is absolutely brilliant, gives a real insight into your life. And I knew this anyway, but you're so passionate about tennis. You're so passionate about grassroots tennis, aren't you, as well? And this is something that's been with you forever, hasn't it, pretty much?
Yeah, I mean, I started playing when I was 10. I mean, I come from the wooden racket era, and you probably had to be about 10 before you could actually be strong enough to pick a racket up back then. And of course a court was big and tennis balls at that time were quite heavy, but my parents played, so it was, sport was in the family, and tennis most certainly was. And you know, when the boys were small, I wanted them to enjoy sport. And of course, because I was coaching as a volunteer at our tennis club a couple of days a week, they got used to spending a lot of time around there. But I mean, we could never have imagined that we would all end up doing what we're doing. I mean, who would have thought that, you know, two little brothers from a small town in Scotland that doesn't really do tennis would end up being Grand Slam champions, or that I would have a career in tennis coaching? Never would have thought that for one moment.
There is so much to talk about. And watching Driving Force, Judy, honestly, I found it incredibly emotional, like so much of it. Made me want to cry. I don't know why, in a good way, but I think I'm very, very passionate about sport, that I can appreciate so much, you know, and I'm a mother as well, so much of what you've been through. But I think, you know, as Lou said, this podcast is about you, and you just kind of blew me away, the strength of character you had. And I'll just read one of your quotes. It says, "If you tell me I can't do something, I will go out of my way to prove you wrong." And I love that. And this podcast is all about, you know, empowering women. And that's why you are such a brilliant guest, Judy.
Yeah, thank you. I think a bit of Scottish bloody mindedness in there. But yeah, I think when, you know, when I started coaching at the club, I was a volunteer and I wasn't a coach, but I had played the game to a good level. So I knew how to teach people how to play the game without doing any of the technical stuff. So, you know, I kind of taught myself how to coach because there wasn't anybody to learn from. And I think that really from that stage, I just got used to, I need to make things happen. because nobody else is going to do it. And I still have that mentality. If I see something that I want to do or that needs to be done, I don't wait for somebody else to do it. I get off my butt and do it myself. So, you know, starting at the club, which I'd grown up at that club, and it was a wonderful community club where all the adults played with the kids. And, you know, so much now you find at clubs, it's all about organized group coaching, and you don't get that interaction across generations. So for me, I realized as a young mum that I couldn't do everything myself. So I created a what became a mum's army, you know, mums to run competitions, to run the teams, to run the cafe, to run the quiz nights or the social things. Or if it was raining, you bring a big bag of toys down and you organize things. So it just became a great place to hang out. But I think doing that, I've always understood the power of community. But I've also understood the power of women supporting other women. And we created a wonderful community hub for the children there. You know, I think as I went on through coaching, you know, I was never stepping on anybody's toes in Scotland because there was no toes to step on. There was no infrastructure. So it was like, right, what do I have to do next? Or what needs to be in place for these kids to progress? And a lot of that was about making things happen. And a lot of it was about investing in myself by doing more coaching qualifications, attending workshops and conferences in other countries to try to learn. Because I really had a big thing for wanting to create the same opportunities for the Scottish kids as were available in other countries. So I set about creating an infrastructure and ended up at some point, you know, passing the LTA's Performance Coach Award, which I was the first woman to pass that. And as a result of passing that, I ended up becoming the Scottish National Coach. And that gave me opportunity on a much wider scale to set up what became a great little development school. And out of our development school that started with 20 kids, aged between 7 and 11, and four of them ended up playing Davis Cup, and one was British number one for many years and played Fed Cup. That was Elena Baltasha. And it, I think what it showed me was it's all about people, isn't it? Because when I started as national coach, I had no staff. I had a tiny salary. It was 25 grand. I had a budget for the whole country, which was 90 grand. This was in 1995. And I literally had a bucket of balls and a block booking on a few indoor courts, which was the only indoor centre that we had in Scotland at the time. And because I didn't have any staff, what did I do? I brought the parents in and I said, you're going to have to help me. I can make certain things happen, but I can't do it all. So, you know, from car shares to putting up other kids overnight, to teaching them to run competitions or manage matches. So I'm a huge believer in investing in people and the power of community. And I think what we achieved at the end of it in terms of the players we produced and the coaches we produced, I mean, we produced Leon Smith, who's the Davis Cup captain and head of men's tennis at the LTA. We achieved a lot with a very little. And so it's always, my thing is always, it's not about what you have, it's what you do with what you have. And if you surround yourself with good people and you all work together, you've no idea just what you can make happen.
Honestly, just listening to that just makes me quite emotional, actually, because to start, you know, and you put it well, to start from the bucket of balls to where you've gone to, and also your boys have gone to as well. Let's talk about a little bit about as well for tennis for you. And, you know, because we talk so much in this podcast about, you know, whether you do it because it makes you feel happy, because it makes you feel physically good. What is tennis? What was the essence of tennis for you, do you think?
I think when I was a player, I loved the mental challenge of tennis, because it's you against somebody else, and every opponent is different, and you have to work out the battle plan. You know, you have to assess the strengths and the weaknesses. It's thinking it out for yourself, and it's trying to outsmart. So, you know, if you're playing somebody who's much bigger than you and therefore more powerful, how do you disadvantage them? So I have three things that I say: how do you cause trouble to your opponent? How do you avoid trouble? So what can they hurt you with, and how do you stop them doing it? And how do you get out of trouble? So they put you in a difficult situation, how do you get out of trouble? So those three things are my coaching questions. And I have a style of coaching where I ask kids questions all the time, because it's not about what I know. It's about what they know, or what I can get them to say about how they feel or what they see is happening on the court. And that's why I have this thing about coaching now, that there's too much coaching, there's too much spoon feeding, you know, and we all have gadgets that give us the answers to things. You know, we're not using our brains enough, and tennis is a very cerebral sport. That was what I enjoyed about it as a player, and I was a good athlete, so I loved the whole running around. I loved the physical challenge of it as well. And I think that, you know, when I started to coach at the club, I just loved sharing my sport with others, enthusing others. And I was fascinated in observing how people learned, and we all learn differently. And I like the challenge of working out, how do I get the best out of whoever is in front of me, because they are all different. And really, that's still what I love. I don't care if I have 60-year-old beginner or a 8-year-old potential superstar. I don't care who they are. It's like, how can I help you to improve? So yeah, I think I love my sport, and I love teaching it. I love sharing it.
I'm going to remember that. So it was how to cause trouble, how to stop trouble, and how to get out of trouble. Because that could be like a life lesson in some way. I mean, not maybe the causing of the trouble, but maybe you disrupting is a good thing. And lots of people talk to you about you as being a disruptor, which has been a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, on the tennis court, you have to disrupt your opponent's rhythm. You have to stop them from doing what they want to do. And I think, Billie Jean King calls me a disruptor, and she's like the queen. She's the queen of disruption, and she's my absolute shero. And I still have to pinch myself that she has become a good friend of mine, you know, that I can go out for dinner with her. I work with her, because she was someone that I would watch on TV when I was a little girl, and her playing Wimbledon, because that was pretty much all the tennis that was on TV back then, black and white TV, you know, when I was small. And now I get the chance to do events with her, and I worked with her on World Team Tennis last year. But yeah, you know, I think, you know, what I love about her is, you know, she fought for equality for women 50 years ago when she broke away with the original nine, which were nine tennis women who got together, and they were sick of the men getting 90% of the gate and the women getting 10%. And they were playing to a great level that was just complete unfairness. And they took this massive risk and broke away and set up what is now the women's tour. And it's why tennis is so far ahead of all the other sports in terms of what it brings to women, in terms of equality of opportunity, prize money, endorsements, TV coverage, etc. So, and she continues to disrupt for equality, not just on gender, on absolutely everything. She really uses her voice, and she's really encouraged me to try to use mine.
It's incredible when you see the amount of powerful women there are in the world trying to make these changes, though. But it is only sort of 10 years ago where you said you were at the US Open in New York, and the ITF, International Tennis Federation, had announced their new board with 14 people on it, and they were all men. You know, 10 years on, are we moving on? I mean, we're talking about the women's tour, but, you know, how is equality really going in tennis in general, do you think?
I think at the top end of the game, it's way ahead of the other sports, and it is as close to the men as we might hope it would be. You know, in the Grand Slams, which are the main events on the tennis tour, the prize money is equal. There's always a debate about the men play best of five, so therefore they put more energy and more time in, and the women play best of three. But the prize money is equal, that the coverage is pretty equal, the endorsement opportunities are really great. So tennis is in a good place, I think, at the top of the game. I think when it comes to the general tour, market forces kick in. And for sure, there is more prize money on the men's side of the tour, because more sponsors want to get involved in the men's side of the game. And I think that's something that you see through all sports, that there is still a reluctance to invest as heavily on the women's side of the game because there isn't the visibility. So it's a little bit chicken and egg. You know, you need the visibility to create the bums on seats, eyes on screens, and from visibility comes mass participation, hopefully, but also sponsorship and endorsement opportunities. So one of the things I find myself constantly arguing for is equality of investment in women's sport from grassroots, you know, opportunity to participate, equal opportunity to compete, equal opportunities to become performers. Because if we invest in female performers, whether that's individual or whether that's teams, people get behind teams in a bigger way, you know, whether that's local or national teams. But if we invest in the performance and we get the performance up to a world-class level, then it becomes more watchable. When it becomes more watchable, you will find more media coverage because people want to see it. People will pay for tickets. And then the whole thing has this knock on, sponsors get more involved, and with more money in the game, the athletics or swimming or whatever it is, then you can grow it more. So the visibility is absolutely key. And you keep hearing athletes saying, if you can see it, you can be it. And that's a huge part of the challenge for women's sport, is becoming more visible.
Just a question here about the five sets. So both Louise and I are, you know, big endurance athletes. That was my background, triathlon. You know, we're seeing now more and more in sports like ultra running that, you know, women are actually beating men, because from an endurance side of things, we are incredibly strong. I just wonder why women don't go to five sets, you know, and that's a question. And the reason being is I always have this discussion with my husband. So it'd be really interesting. I'm like,
who listens to this podcast, by the way, Judy, all the time.
Oh my gosh, he's the most avid listener. Oh my goodness, it's amazing. But the question is, why don't women play five sets when surely physically they would be more than capable?
Good point.
I think they would be capable of playing five sets. My preference would be to see the men playing three sets. I think, when I've witnessed many Australian Open, for example, where it's incredibly hot, it's the height of the Australian summer, they're regularly playing matches in 40 degrees. And when you're out there for five sets, which could take 4 or 5 hours, that takes an enormous toll on both players, but particularly on the winner, because they've got to play again, you know, they get 24 hours rest and then they play again the following day. But if you're out there for 5 hours on your own in what is a pretty non-stop sport, it's incredibly grueling. It also means that the male players are the top ones anyway, that are likely to survive through into the second week of a slam. They're not going to play doubles or mixed doubles because it's just all going to be too much. Whereas the women can play doubles and mixed doubles because the three sets doesn't take quite as much out of them. So there is an argument that the women have more opportunity to make more money because they can actually play in more events. So I think having witnessed the toil that Andy has put through his body through the last however many years of being incredibly successful at Grand Slam level, you know, you've got to win 7 matches in 13 days, best of 5 sets to win a Grand Slam. I mean, that is absolutely huge. And I have to laugh when I hear, you know, footballers saying, oh, well, you know, we've got 7 days to recover for the next football match. And I'm like, wow, 90 minutes and there's 11 of you out there. So, yeah, I'd rather see the men playing three than the women playing five.
You're making a really good point, because also, Annie, the point about, you know, endurance athletes is, yeah, okay, so I do an Ironman. I don't do one, like, I wouldn't want to do one for like 3 months. You said, I mean, you wouldn't do, you know, like, a marathon, most people, followed by a marathon 2 days later, would you? You wouldn't do that. So do you make a really good point, Judy? And it would probably be, would it be more exciting viewing as well, do you think? I mean, they are wonderful sometimes, those five setters, aren't they? They're just epic for as viewers.
Yeah, I think they are. And you have them in the slams, you have them in the Davis Cup as well, and you know they are incredible mental and physical endurance battles. But I think there's a lot to be said for sport meets entertainment, and entertainment now, if we go to watch a football match or we go to watch a movie, is probably pocketed into the best part of 2 hours, where, you know, how many people, and especially of the next generation, the young people, how many of them will sit for four or five hours and watch a match through to from start to finish? I'm not so sure. I think my feeling is I'd rather see the men playing best of three. But I have to say, I've seen some unbelievable five set battles, not just involving Andy and Jamie, but, you know, with others. That, I mean, it's the height of sport. But I think the world is changing, and I think you always have to be able to adapt to. You know, it's got to be bums on seats and eyes on screens, hasn't it, at the end of the day, because it's got to make financial sense.
You talked about sport and entertainment mixing. Come on, tell us about Strictly. When you got the call up, were you immediately like, yes, I'm in?
At Her Spirit, we know how powerful women can be. We love your strength, your determination, your compassion. We love the energy that sparks when we connect and spur each other on. Her Spirit was created to ignite that flame of determination, to unleash your energy, to build your self-belief, and to help every woman find a way to your healthiest mind, body, and soul yet. We want to inspire 1 million women just like you to be active, healthy, and happy, because you deserve it. Head to herspirit.co.uk, join our core membership and use the code HERSPIRITPOD3 to get 3 months completely free. Join our monthly challenges, get access to the Her Spirit Health Hub and track your activity levels, mood, food, sleep and stress every single week with your own personalised dashboard. Get expert advice and join daily live classes that can be played back at any time. Plus, find the support that you need to get started and stay motivated. Just sign up at herspirit.co.uk and use the code HERSPIRITPOD3 to get 3 months completely free. It's time for you.
Well, what happens is that you're approached to see if you would like to do it. So you have an introductory sort of meetup where I guess they're sort of testing you out and you're actually asking questions, you know, what does it mean? How much time am I going to have to give up to this, et cetera, et cetera. And then what happened was that I was so excited. Like, I was desperate to do it because I love Strictly ever since it started. Absolutely loved it. Couldn't believe they asked me. And then I had a kind of a dummy run with Robin Windsor at the Pineapple Studios in London and absolutely loved that as well. So again, I think they're kind of testing you out a little bit. And of course, I was absolutely hopeless, but I think you need a mix of the hopeless people, the somewhere in between and the really good ones. But I, you know, like everything that I do or that the boys do, it kind of impacts on us all as a family. So I thought, right, I'm going to have to run this past the boys. It doesn't matter how much I want to do it. I better just check. So I took the easy option first and I went to Jamie. And so I told him.
I was wondering if he might be the easy option.
Yeah, he's the easy option for sure. And he said, oh, Mum, you love Strictly. That'll be great. You'll have a great time. Yeah, do it. That'll be great. And then I asked Andy what he thought, and he just looked at me, kind of stared at me for a full sort of 10 seconds with his deadpan face and said, oh my God, you'll be rubbish. And it was so funny because it's exactly what I would have expected Andy to say. But the thing is that they were both right. I did love it and I was rubbish. But, you know, it was so good because for me, it was the first thing that I'd done just for me that had nothing to do with tennis for years. And you were stepping into somebody else's world. And it was, you know, the costumes and the makeup and not my world at all. I mean, I'm tracksuit and jeans and a hoodie or a baseball cap or whatever. And, you know, you really have to give up whatever it is that you do, yeah, or be prepared to give it up for 3 or 4 months because you don't know how far you're going to get, and everything kind of kicks off in August. And I would have to say I had the best partner ever in Anton Dubec. We just laughed all day long, and he tried to teach me how to dance, and I tried to teach him how to play tennis, and we just became really great friends, and absolutely love him. I couldn't have had a better partner. And I think for me, the whole stepping out of your comfort zone and making yourself do something that you are not good at, it's brand new, you're just really struggling to learn it, and you're performing it in front of a live audience and judges and millions of people watching on the TV. But every time you go out of your comfort zone and you survive, doesn't matter if you're good or not, you survived it. It gives you a confidence. And I think that was a great message for me and for me to give to other women of a certain age. You know, why shouldn't we enjoy ourselves? Why shouldn't we try something else? Don't be afraid to make a fool of yourself. Exactly. What's the worst thing that can happen, you know?
Oh, I'm trying not to listen to you, Judy, because it makes me feel a little bit... The fear, I'll come to you, hold on, the fear, you know, you talking me through that just makes you feel a little bit sort of sick with fear.
The fear on the whole thing was the best fun until Saturday night, when you're standing up there and they're announcing your name, you know, dancing the whatever, and you have to walk down the stairs, and then you've got a minute or so while they play your VT. And I'm terrified that I'm not going to remember what the first step is, or that I'm going to trip on the heels because I never wear heels. And oh, the terror of that. And it doesn't matter. I mean, I spent a lot of my life teaching people how to deal with staying calm under pressure. But this is not my world, and this is something I'm not good at. And, you know, honestly, it was really terrifying. And I'm saying to myself, it's 90 seconds. You've been practicing all week. But you get caught up in, it's so easy to be distracted by the lights and the cameras and the crowd and the music and the announcements and Tess and Claudia and the judges. But without question, that's one of the best things that I've done in my life.
You're not going to like this, Louise, but Judy, don't you think Louise would be a brilliant contestant?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, for good, she would be absolutely brilliant.
I would be exactly like you, Judy. I would be really enjoy the training and be this is no offence to you, but I would be rubbish. You weren't rubbish.
I was kind of rubbish.
The other thing also, I like you, I've got two children. And I've two girls, and don't worry, Judy, they were both, I mean, I'm vetoed, but there's lots of million reasons why I wouldn't do Strictly, mostly because I'm too terrified and also rubbish. But also, I'm on a lifetime ban from the girls anyway, so lucky you didn't get a lifetime ban.
I think if I went to them with something else, I might get the lifetime ban. But the funny thing was that I think that they were, once I had agreed to do it and we were getting going, I think they were terrified that I was going to make a fool of myself and therefore possibly make a fool of them, or that people would be nasty about me. I think they were really worried about that I would be the first out and that it would be, you know, because Andy said to me, Mum, you do know you're putting yourself in front of an enormous audience and you can't dance. And I went, I know, but it's okay. And it's funny that, you know, the more that I survived in it, by about week four, they were sending me critiques of what I'd done, you know, because they were watching it. Wherever they were in the world, they were finding a way to watch it. And then they would say, what dance are you doing next week? And then they'd start sending me YouTube clips and things of what I was doing next. And this is what this is supposed to look like. So they went into absolute kind of performance coach mode on my behalf. It was hilarious, really hilarious. And I had obviously no aspirations that I was going to win anything. I was probably like most of the others in it. You just don't want to go home because you're enjoying yourself too much.
Driving Force, your brilliant new program, you talked about girls and sport. So you're just talking there about the media and how, you know, you'll be ridiculed and people have had a go at you. And you've suffered that for a long time, you know, being Andy Murray's mum, you know, an incredibly tough world. So I don't know how I've linked that one to girls in sport, but there is that thing where we're always questioning what we do. And you talk in your program about the drop off of in sport in women now, sort of being, instead of about 14, 15, it's dropping to 11, 12, which is absolutely shocking, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, it used to be that the drop-off was somewhere between 14 and 16, 17. And I think girls are just growing up so much quicker now because of the internet and who the role models are, you know, who is visible to them. And again, it's another reason why we need to increase the visibility of our top sportswomen so that, you know, young people can see them, you know, can understand what it is that they do, what they train. I mean, I think, you know, in one of the episodes of Driving Force, we have Dina Asher-Smith, who's, you know, at one time was the fastest teenager in the world. I mean, what a great tag that is. And when I was talking to her, she told me that the reason she went to the running club at her school, age 8, was that her best friend bribed her with an ice cream. And I thought it was fun, but it also made me realise this, the whole thing about getting girls into any kind of sport or physical activity, it's all about fun, friends and fitness. You're far more likely to go along to something and stay in something if your friends are there. So I'm a big believer in the need for having more women in the female sporting workforce, because women were once girls and women therefore understand better, I think, how to create environments in which girls can thrive, because very few are going to end up becoming performers, but everybody can stay in it because they enjoy it, and you enjoy it if the environment is right. So I spend a lot of time trying to encourage women to get involved in the delivery of sport. And that's not just coaching, you know, it could be being an official or the lady who runs the cafe at the club, or, you know, because we just need more women around to make it a more stimulating place for girls.
We've got lots of questions for you. Should we do some of these? This is from Mel, and she says, having two boys that are elite athletes, how do you deal with and when either of them lose confidence and belief in themselves? I mean, and we, in that documentary, I mean, there's that terrible press conference, which Andy talks about how much pain he is in. And you talked about that as well. But, you know, I know from what I've seen you talk about, there have been, you know, very difficult moments watching your children go through really tough times and under an enormous amount of scrutiny as well. So how do you help them? Because you're also a coach, aren't you? So it's kind of a double-edged thing you're trying to do as a mum and a coach.
Yeah, I think it's, I always felt like it was an advantage to me that I was a coach, particularly as they got further up in the game, because although it's torture to sit and watch them competing at the highest level, I find it really, it actually, it doesn't matter what your child is doing. You want things to go right for them. Just my kids happen to do things on very big stages where they're out there on their own, and there's a lot of expectation from the public, from media, and not least from themselves. And you sit there hoping that everything is going to go right, and you know that you can't do anything about it, really. But I think that when things aren't going well, or when there is a defeat, I think it helped me being a coach. So I wasn't just totally wrapped up in the emotion of it. It was, I can analyze this. I can see what has not worked, and I can see what we need to take back onto the practice court and work on. And from when they were very small, that's always the way that I saw things, was don't get caught up in whether they won or lost, and don't let them get too caught up in the winning or the losing. This is about, what do you need to be able to do better to help you to improve? But you need to get them to talk about it when they're ready. Don't force your opinion on them. And I think that's where the confidence can come from, is that the support system is there. It's not, oh, devastation, I've just lost. It's like, right, okay, it's going to hurt for a little bit, but actually, what could we learn from it? And this is where video cameras on your phone and your live streams on TV, you can watch matches all over the world, and you can capture things yourself, and then you can show them, because then you've got actual evidence. And if they can see it, it's much easier for them to, right, what do I do next? So I think this is where the technical support for the sport and the emotional support from the family and friends around them, that's where that all kicks in, is when things are not going well. When things are going fine, everything's easy. But that's when you really need your team and your family and your friends to really kick in, is when things are not going well. And I think the other thing is not to judge yourself against others, to try to judge yourself against your performance. How do I get a better performance out of you? It's not I'm losing ground, or I'm losing ranking spots to him and I know I'm better than him, or I used to be better than him. Why am I not now? It's all about making it all about you.
Talking about you in the early days as a mum with your boys, you know, this is the thing, I guess, about the press that, you know, kind of doesn't always put the truth out there. They put what they see and they imagine. But both boys talk about how you didn't overpush them. They hung out and they played at the tennis club. And when they weren't playing tennis, they were knocking around, kicking a football with the bigger guys out there. And so it wasn't the case that you pushed them at all, which I think a lot of people do actually believe, oh, you must have been one of these real power mums pushing your boys. And that's absolutely not the truth. You gave them free range to do whatever sport they wanted to. And they chose tennis at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's still one of the things that really bugs me, is, you know, how I got that pushy parent tag or pushy mother tag. You know, way back from Andy's first Wimbledon, I think the media just decided I must be a pushy parent because I was a competitive parent in the player box. I was very visible.
Can I stop you there? I want to stop you there before you go on, because I think what's key to that sentence is you say pushy parent / pushy mother. And I think, you know, and that comes out in the documentary. And I think is, if you'd been a dad, this might have been really different, do you think?
Yeah, I do. I think I realised that very first Wimbledon, when Andy won some matches, and obviously he found himself on the front and back pages, and I sometimes did as well. When, you know, you don't know when cameras are on you, you know, but every picture that they printed of me was, you know, I was pumping my fist or I was baring my teeth. So they made me look like I was this kind of over-competitive, perhaps a little bit aggressive mother. And that was, you know, it's that whole thing. That's what you see and that's what you think. And I am competitive and I should never have to be apologized for being a competitive sportswoman or a competitive mum. You know, and I've always been there supporting the boys in the days when most of their tournaments, nobody was watching them at all, just me. So they're always looking to you for support or encouragement when, usually when things are not going so well. But when they were very little, sometimes when they did a really good shot, they'd look over because they're really pleased with themselves, you know, and you do a little kind of silent clap or whatever. But, you know, I think the nature of Wimbledon is such that, you know, with no ad breaks and, you know, 25 seconds between the points and 90 seconds at the end changes, the cameras and the commentators need somewhere to go. And they go into the player boxes and they talk about who's, you know, who's in there. And I found myself being picked out because I was new, but also I was a little bit of an anomaly as the mum in the player box of sons. And I do think that if I'd been a dad of sons or a mum of daughters or even a dad of daughters, I don't think I would have been picked out the way that I was. And I also realised that if my kids had been exceptional rugby players or cricketers or footballers, I would have been able to sit in the crowd and nobody would ever have seen me because the cameras never go in there at those sports. So I was a product of my environment. And, you know, you still get blamed for being a pushy mother and she's always in front of the camera. And I'm thinking, no, I'm not. I'm just sitting there supporting my kids.
Oh, I do know. I really feel for you because I just think, you know, it. And I feel for you. B, I think you've pushed through that. And you said even that you actually went to go on a PR course. So that's the way you always find a way out, don't you? By educating yourself, learning. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And, you know, and I feel for you because that's just really hurtful, isn't it? And the real you, you know, we've seen you on Strictly. I've seen you on, do you know what I mean? You're a bubbly, effervescent, enthusiastic, optimistic person. And that's just deeply unfair.
Yeah, it was, but it was something I had to live with for, you know, for a number of years. I had given up my job. I was 10 years as a Scottish national coach and I gave up my job to concentrate on helping Andy and Jamie. You know, they were young. You need somebody to take care of all the logistics and the business side of things and make sure, you know, all the entries are in and all the rest of it, because they are too young to be able to do all that and they need to concentrate on what they are doing on the gym and on the court. So I'd ceased to become a coach. I actually became Andy and Jamie's mum. And I think there were many people who thought I just followed them around the world clapping and pumping my fist, when actually what I had to learn was how to manage the life and business of a professional of professional athletes. And you don't learn that easily. You know, I suddenly found myself having to learn how to do tax returns in four different countries, you know, do basic accounting, do the PR course. I learned how to do massage because we had no money. I couldn't afford to pay for people to do the rub downs after the matches. It's all sorts of things. So, it's, you know, as you say, it's like, what is tennis demanding of us now? What are we going to have to do next? What can I learn? Because I haven't got money to pay somebody else to do it. And I think that when I did my book and it came out in 2017, and I did a book tour around the book, it really helped me a lot to talk about the backstory, because I almost felt like I was justifying myself to everybody. Why I was always there. And then I thought, but that's what it made me feel like, that I had to justify why I was around, you know. And I'm not around so much now. I can kind of do my own thing. Thankfully, they can pay people to do all these things for them now. Yes.
And then you became Fed Cup captain, which is absolutely fantastic as well. And the Fed Cup, for those who don't know, is a sort of, how would you describe it? Is it the women's equivalent or beside the Davis Cup? How would you say it?
Yeah, it's the women's version of the Davis Cup. I call it the big sister of the Davis Cup. So it's called the Fed Cup. So it's the women's team, the women, world women's team competition. Yeah, and I got that role at the end of 2011. And it was I can't tell you what a big thing that was for me, because this was somebody recognising that I was a good coach and not just Andy and Jamie's mum. And I did that role for about 5 years. And, you know, never forget the you know, the first matches that we went to, we were in a zone, a Euro-Africa zone. There were 16 teams in it and we were playing in Israel. So it's played in February, beginning of February, just after Australian Open. So you need somewhere outdoors with plenty of courts and sunshine, guaranteed sunshine. So we go to Israel. And it's like playing in a club match. You know, if you're not the host nation, nobody comes to watch because we're in a lower zone. And it was the weirdest thing because I was expecting this kind of all singing, all dancing, having been at many Davis Cups. And then realizing, wow, we're going to have to do our own PR. So this is when we all got into Twitter and Facebook. Instagram wasn't around in those days. We blogged for BBC site. We got pictures of our team in our dresses for Hello and Daily Mail and so forth. So it was the visibility thing again. It's like nobody can see us playing, but we're going to make a noise on social media and in things that women watch. So we were raising the profile of the event and of our individual players. And, you know, our players then were Elena Baltasha and Kiotha Vong were the kind of older guard, and Laura Robson and Heather Watson as very young. Back in 2011, they were very young. So a real mix in the team, and it was a lovely mix. And, you know, my first campaign was successful and we got out of that zone and we got into a playoff for the World Group. And we didn't manage to get through, but I could see the potential of investing in the performances and bringing this team together to try to create something. And by the time I finished, we had Konta Baltasha sadly had died, and Kiotha Vong was about to retire. Heather and Laura were there, and Joanna Konta was starting to come through. She had just made semis of Australian Open. So we had the makings of a team that could survive in the World Group. And then we, you know, in the last year or so, we've had a couple of home matches that have been incredible atmosphere, just like Davis Cup, not quite such big venues, but sold out. And it absolutely proved to me that I was absolutely right, that if we get to a level where we can have home ties like the men do, we can really grow the profile.
There were so many amazing quotes from amazing people on your new TV programme on Sky. But one that sort of stood out for me was one that Sue Barker said about you. She said, "Judy knocked down walls I never thought anyone could get through." I mean, that to me would be the biggest compliment anyone could pay me, I think. What do you think is your biggest wall that you've knocked down?
It's tough to say because the whole thing's been a journey. Everything's kind of knocked on to, you know, to something else. I think the boys winning titles at Wimbledon, Andy winning the Olympics, I think it's tough to say, but nobody would ever have expected that two brothers from, you know, from a small town in a country that doesn't really do tennis, would be able to do something like that. And I suppose it's probably been a series of walls or doors that it's like, right, what's next? And whenever people close the door on me or put a hand up to me and sort of run along, don't be silly, we don't produce tennis players in Scotland, or, well, you know, well, he's quite good, but, you know, there's no guarantees, and okay, you can have a little bit of this. You know, it was almost tokenism. It was too easily sort of brushed away, and actually used that always to as a fuel, really, that whole thing. You know, if you tell me I'm being stupid or I can't do it, I really am going to prove you wrong. And I think that's been the biggest satisfaction, I think, has been, you know, for all those who sent people up when I was a Scottish national coach to tell me what I should be doing with the kids that were in my stable. And I'm thinking, so you come up once or twice a year for a day, you have a quick look, you tell me what to do, and then you bugger off again. And it's like, you don't care for all these kids the way that I care for them. And I think it has just been that whole thing, probably, of just smashing that it's not about the title that you have, or the pay that you have, or the kudos that you have. This is all about people, and people working together with a passion, a common passion, with a belief, working hard, appreciating everybody that's around you. And I think now, you know, it's opened a lot of doors for me. And I you know, I work with the WTA as one of their community ambassadors. And so I travel around the world to their bigger events, and I deliver workshops or conferences or clinics for I try to teach people how to teach tennis or how to get others started in whatever space they have available. So we go into a lot of disadvantaged areas. So for me, it's all about growing the game. And of course, I have a particular desire to grow female coaches around the world. So I use my, or I try to use my profile and the fact that I am a female coach who people recognise to do that. And I continue to do that. And I still think there's a lot of ceilings that I still need to smash through to get anywhere close to the equality of opportunity that I would like to see for women in sport, not just in tennis. So I think it's carry on smashing.
I love that.
and you will. Can I ask a question from Amanda? She says, she wants to ask you, how did you focus on your career and fitness while supporting your sons? I think you've probably talked really mostly about the career, haven't you? What about fitness as well?
Yeah, I think a lot of people think that I am fit because they see me.
You look fit.
I know, and I think that's I'm pretty much still the same size as I was when I was a student, and I think it's probably because I'm busy. I'm constantly mentally busy as well, and I think that helps. I can't say that I have a fitness regime or ever have had, but I'm always on the go, you know. So whether I'm coaching or doing something else, I'm always on the move. And you know, now I think as I've got older, I realise that I need to work a little bit harder at it. And certainly through COVID, with everything being shut, you're having to get the motivation yourself to do things. And through the summer, my bike was my absolute saviour. You know, I live in the countryside, so actually exploring the countryside around where I am, I got myself up to about 20 miles a day. But the fresh air and the exercise combo, I mean, phenomenal. My bike is not out just now because the weather's not so great, but I'm a member of a leisure club that's attached to a hotel, and the leisure facility has stayed open even though the hotel's closed. So I go and swim and I exercise in the water, and I really enjoy that. So I think it's about finding things that you enjoy doing. It's not about doing loads or being in pain or whatever. It's doing what you like doing and doing enough of it. I call it my JETSA workout, JETSA, just enough to stay alive.
I love that.
So don't overdo it or you'll get aches and pains, but find something that you enjoy doing and do as much of it as you wish.
Do you know what? I mean, having had my foot operated on and gone from like huge amount of exercise to very little, I might do jets. I probably won't, Judy, but I'm certainly in that kind of zone at the moment. And you're in our club because Annie and I, we are fair weather cyclists as well. And then do you think your approach has changed? I mean, it sounds like your approach to sort of mental health and well-being and exercise has kind of changed actually over the last year.
Yeah, I think it has, because the things that I used to enjoy are no longer available. So things like Zumba classes, dance aerobics. I like going to the classes. I like doing things with the other women. And whether it's a 45 minute or an hour class, I like the exercising to music. I like the chit chat. The ladies who run the classes are, you know, big personalities. And these things have, you know, they've been kind of part and parcel of my life the last few years. And now you can't do them. So I've actually found on YouTube some things that I really enjoy. For example, there's a thing called the Happy Mile. So you put it on, it's about 15 minutes, but it's enough steps for a mile. But you do, let's say, 30 seconds of a couple of side steps or a forwards and backwards step or a marching on the spot thing. And it's constantly changing, so you never get bored of it. And that really appeals to me because it's JETSA again. It's 15 minutes. I know I've done a mile. I do that. I do my swimming. I'll go out and have a little walk if the weather's okay. And I think that's good for me. I'm not so good with my diet because I find when I get bored, and especially if I'm in the house a lot, I'm always reaching for a cup of coffee, and I can't have coffee or tea without a biscuit or a piece of cake. But I eat a lot of fruit and I eat a lot of veg, but I'm a bit of a cakeist.
I love the way I read today when I found out that we had the same birthday. I read today that your favourite word is snacksident. What is a snacksident?
It's a mixture of snack and accident. It's when, you know, like I'm really bad with chocolate fingers and I have to really make myself almost like close my eyes and walk past them in the supermarket, because if I take a box, I know that when I start them, I can't stop until I finish the whole thing. And I call it a snackcident because it's almost like I accidentally finished the whole box.
Yeah. So you just can't buy them then?
Yeah, I just have to walk past them.
I wish I have to do that. I have to do that with crisps. Maybe that should be my New Year's resolution for 2021. Just to not to buy, not to look at, just get them out of my head, crisps. They are my absolute
downfall. No, just
that,
you know what? It's just a little bit of everything, isn't it? You know, that's the sensible way to live, you know. I hate to use the word moderation because that just uses, you know, boring to me. But, you know, you can have the biscuits and you can have the crisps and stuff, but just do, you know, a little bit. And I think it's interesting talking with Judy about how you are as a person. I don't really stop moving either. And sometimes when I've seen myself on camera, I'm like, God, I've got worms in my body or something. I don't sit still. And I think that's probably just like in your genetic makeup, isn't it? But on this podcast, we're always talking about, you know, and promoting movement rather than sort of exercise, sport that someone has to go and do. Fight, as you rightly said, find something that you really enjoy and do it little and often and keep moving. Because if we do that, then we're going to stay healthier a lot longer.
Absolutely.
I've got to let you go in a minute, Judy. You're a granny too. How's that?
that is great. That is great. Andy has three kids under five.
Wow.
And, you know, me, I'm kind of on the go all the time. So I am a very active granny and I get absolutely knackered because I'm always playing, and it's another reason for me to try and keep fit. I think the whole stretching thing for me has become important as I've got older, because I want to be able to chase after my grandkids. I want to be able to pick them up and get up and down easily, and you know, so the stretching thing again, it's about finding the right series of stretches that you can do. And it's so easy to do because a lot of them you can do sitting watching TV or lying on the floor watching TV or on your bed. So that's a really important thing. And I think, you know, having been sporty and active all of my days, I don't want to get to a stage where I'm struggling to get down the stairs or I can't run quickly to pick one of the kids up if they are heading towards a puddle or something like that. So I think, yeah, the stretching thing, and stretching doesn't have to be like a chore. I think you can get a lot of enjoyment out of that. Put on some music that you like. I mean, music for me, that doing that happy mile, the music is great and it goes in quickly. It's five songs of 3 minutes and I can get through it easily. That's the way I look at it. Five songs, 3 minutes, playlist, easy.
Brilliant. Well, listen, I'm going to take away so much away from this podcast. Hasn't she been a brilliant guest, our first guest of the year, Annie?
Absolutely love talking to Judy. I think some of your advice has just been absolutely amazing, and hopefully people will get a lot out of this. And also, if you haven't seen Driving Force, it's great. Switch into that as well, because
yeah.
I absolutely love that for so many reasons. And I sort of felt slightly empowered by it, Louise. I don't know about you when I came about it, but it just kind of jolted mm-hmm. my mind to sort of think about things that I should be doing too. And I think we all should be always dipping into and listening and reading stuff from people like Judy, who is just, for me, an incredibly sort of motivating and inspiring woman.
Judy Murray, in our matching red polonex, it's been such a pleasure to spend time with you. Thank you so much. And I will obviously be wishing you a happy birthday on my birthday next year.
Yeah, we won't forget that one. Thanks for having me, ladies. That was great
Thank
fun.
You. Lots of love. Thank you.
Bye.
That was so lovely to speak to Judy Murray. Annie, and also we've had on the podcast, listening to that, Amanda Howard, who is from Medichex, which is, of course, one of the sponsors. Thank you very much, by the way, of this podcast. Without you, we wouldn't be able to chat for hours and hours over the last few months. Amanda, what did you make of listening to Judy?
Oh, wow. Isn't she inspiring? I loved the, if someone says I can't do anything, I go out of my way to do it. And, you know, the fact that she's broken down so many walls, I think it's amazing. I think she's done a fantastic job.
And I love the way she sort of, if she sees a problem, she finds a way around it, doesn't it? Like sending herself on a PR course or, you know, we all sort of think, you know, you could give up, but she's so determined to sort of find her way through things.
And yeah, and I think for lots of us, that's how this year's been. Mm. About actually, we've all had challenges that they didn't expect or didn't know what to do with. And I think, yes, I mean, you saw a completely different side, completely different from the way she's portrayed in the press, you know, and she's such an amazing, inspiring woman. I want to go and watch that documentary now.
Amanda, it's great to have you on as a guest. And as just backing up with what Lou said there, big thank you for your support on our podcast and sponsoring the Her Spirit podcast. How are you doing, Amanda? Because we always like to ask our guests, how are we doing? And we're on a Zoom call and you are in your attic where you've been for quite a long time, haven't you, this year?
Yes. So I did get into the office a bit during summer, but most of my working life has been in the attic and it's been tough. You know, I think I'm a person who likes to be around people. You know, I get my stimulation from working with my team and spending time with them and sparking ideas. And it's quite hard when you're on your own, particularly when it's cold and dark. And a huge difference for me has been actually, you know, I have the privilege of working with Her Spirit professionally, but also being a personal member and actually kind of getting out and running with the Give Me Five challenge. You know, I've never run in December since I was at school outside. So that's a good 30 odd years ago, if not more, you know, and I think that whole community around getting out, you know, I run in the early morning as the sun comes up. I'm lucky to live near a river, and I would have just thought it's cold, dark, I can't do it. And it's been a lifesaver because I have chance to think, I have chance to breathe, you know, and I start the day in a really positive way. And also the great thing through Her Spirit is I've also found a running mate
who
lives around the corner. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
She lives around the corner. She's the same age as me. And it was only because we worked out that we were posting pictures of the same place. And we kind of went, let's meet. I think it's the third week now. And we've discovered we're a similar age. We work in a similar sector.
But that talks to a lot of what Judy was talking about there, wasn't she? She was talking about community and how important. And I feel, you know, again, part of that community with Annie and, you know, the podcast for me feels like a sort of family, actually. And that's been so important, hasn't it, back in 2020 to get us through, actually.
I think it has. And I think the lovely thing about the podcast and Her Spirit more generally is you see the kind of the plus and the negatives and positives. So you see that everyone has good times and bad times. And you almost have that comfort to be able to admit when you're not okay. The best thing about the community is kind of the days you go, I'm not feeling all right. And also the days you go, I had a big thing because I'm not a runner, but I've started and I'm slow, but I've kind of worked out that's fine. And actually, each day I'm going a bit quicker or a bit further. And actually, the only person I need to race is me. But I had a huge hang up about, you know, I wasn't good enough to do it. And I think that's a woman thing.
I love that message, Amanda. Thank you. I mean, it is a bit difficult for me because my background was sport and I've done a lot of sport. And, you know, if one thing I find relatively easy to do in life, it's to do sport. But I really recognise it's not easy for everyone. But when you do start, it's never as hard as you think it's going to be. You've done all the right things, like, you know, being on the Her Spirit app, having that community around you. I think it's important for you to sort of like tell in your words. So for me, it's easy to say, you know, I've done it for years. It's what I do most naturally. But for you, it's not. January, Amanda, is a really tough time of year to run. It's dark and miserable. How do you kind of get outside? Because everyone goes, oh, too cold, too wet. But I know that once I've got outside, within 30 seconds, you've got about the rain. You forgot about the fact you're going to get a bit muddy and cold.
I actually put it as a meet appointment in my diary. So I actually schedule the time and I run early because otherwise I know I just get distracted and sit at my desk all day, but I make an appointment. And I think the breakthrough for me is it stopped being a chore. I now actually look forward to it because I know I feel better. And I think once you've been wet a few times, it's you realize you don't melt.
yeah. And that's such a brilliant shift. I know also you've set yourself a goal for this year, haven't you?
Yes, I'm doing a go try in Leeds.
Yay! Fingers crossed we'll see you, because fingers crossed it will go ahead, and Annie and I will, fingers crossed, not sure how many fingers I can cross, will be there reporting on the Leeds Triathlon.
Yes, so six of us are doing it from work, but I think I'm the oldest by about 25 years.
Yeah, whatever. It doesn't matter. Age is not a thing in triathlon. It's a good thing.
Yeah, so Mel's had me doing the Learn to Freestyle course, which I think she was appalled by my stroke, but we'll go back to it once we can and we'll work on it. So, yes, I think a bit like Judy was saying earlier, I kind of like doing things I don't think I can do. I like going out of my comfort zone and going, well, I'm not meant to be able to do it, but I won't know unless I try.
Well, listen, we will guarantee, fingers crossed, et cetera, that we will be there on the finishing line. We probably won't be allowed to give you a hug, but we will be able to do the Judy Murray fist pump, won't
we? Yes, definitely.
Oh, Amanda, thank you so much.
No, thank you, guys. And it's been great being involved and listening to you. You do really make our day.
Thank you.
And thank you very much. And seriously, on behalf of everybody who listens to this podcast, because without people sponsoring it, we couldn't be doing it. So we really appreciate it. Take care and we will see you there.
Cheers, bye.
See you soon, Annie.
Bye, Lou.
Hi, my name's Mel Berry and I'm one of the co-founders of Her Spirit. I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast. These podcasts would not have been made possible without the support of the brilliant MediChecks. MediChecks offer an easy and affordable way to check your health with their simple and personalized blood tests. From hormones and nutrition to cholesterol and diabetes, there is something for everyone. Just go to MediChecks.com to find out more. Have a great day.